Welcome to the Story Night podcast, where you hear true stories on a theme, recorded live on stage and without notes. I'm your host, Jessica Holmes. This week, we'll go back to August 2010, and the theme, Dog Days, Stories of Summer. We'll hear from one featured storyteller and one story slammer, who both happen to focus on the sometimes perilous combination of car trips and marital relations. Featured storyteller Jan Schlicht goes first, with a story about heading west on a backpacking adventure for a lifetime with her husband.
Good evening. This is the story of an excellent summer adventure. In May of 1973, my husband Larry and I took off from Madison, Wisconsin, to go backpacking in the American West. I know people have been exploring the American West since Lewis and Clark and possibly before. This is true. For our age group, this was practically a rite of passage to head out to the American West to see its beauty and to experience its solitude and to try to forget that Richard Nixon was still president. There were, however, a couple of unique features of our trip. One was that most of our cohort were traveling in VW microbuses. Our car was a Plymouth Satellite station wagon. You can't pimp that ride. It was the most staid, boring, middle-class car you could drive. It was bourgeois in a time when bourgeois was not cool. Also, we had no dope in the back of the car. So we had no illusions that we were going to recreate Jack Kerouac's adventure and be famous. We were not cool, and we were fine with that. It took a lot of planning for us to get ready for this trip. We were complete novices. Neither of us had ever backpacked. We liked the idea of backpacking, but we have never done it. And we also really had never even camped. So we started, where most novices would start. We got a book. And the book we started with was The Complete Walker by Colin Fletcher. The reason I can remember that almost 40 years later is because that book was like a Bible to us. We read every single word that Colin had to say. We believed everything he said, and we did everything he said. He told us that we had to get rid of all the extra weight in our backpacks, and to do that, we had to saw the ends off our toothbrushes so that we wouldn't have that extra weight, and that toothpaste was much too heavy, so we had to get this stuff called Dr. Bonner's peppermint soap, which was useful for washing hands, washing dishes, and brushing teeth. And believe me, when I think about it, I can still remember the taste of Dr. Bonner's in my mouth. So we read the book. We thought we should get a little practical experience. But remember, we were in Wisconsin. I don't know if you've ever been there. There is a ski hill in Wisconsin. I think it's about 300 feet above the surrounding land. There's no way to reproduce in Wisconsin anything that you would experience backpacking in the American West. We did put on our hiking boots, and we walked around Madison with our hiking boots on. That was what Colin told us to do that. And we also found out, sort of serendipitously, that there's a backpacking park just outside of Madison, if you can imagine. So it was like this acreage, I don't know how many acres, with some trees on it, a chain link fence around it. You had to pay money to get in, so we paid our money. We took our tent, we had our backpacks all the way packed. We walked around this, you know, fenced area for a while. We put up our tent, and we really wanted to test out our little darling backpacking stove. It was so cute. And we had heard that Knorr dried soups were good for backpacking, lightweight, pretty flavorful. And so we took some Knorr soup with us. And after we walked around, we got our stove out and fired it up, and we cooked the soup. And it probably would have been delicious if it had been a cool day. But in Wisconsin in the summer, it's about 95 degrees and 100% humidity. The sweat was pouring off of us. Soup did not taste very good, but we had nothing else to eat, so we ate it anyway. And there was one other thing. Wisconsin is famous for three things. Cheese, of course. Green Bay Packers, of course. The third thing is mosquitoes. There might be somebody in here who's from Minnesota or Alaska who would argue with me about it, but I'm telling you, mosquitoes and Wisconsin, they are a pair. And so we had these net things that hung out over our faces, made it hard to eat soup. And it's not It's not so much the bites, the mosquito bites are bad, but it's the swarm of things around your head whining and whining. So as quickly as we could, we ditched the soup, we dove into the tent, and we got as far away from Mother Nature as we possibly could. We were awakened once in the night by a wild animal. It was a cow in the next pasture. That's how we knew we were still in Wisconsin. So that was our experience. We also, several months before we left, we thought we had to get our food ready for the trip. We're going to be gone for 4 months. We're on a budget. So you couldn't go on the internet and Google backpacking food. I don't know how we got this, but we got a catalog from REI. And this is when REI was a single brick-and-mortar store in Seattle. And we poured through that catalog, and we arrived at what we thought was really a fabulous pantry for our summer. The first thing was Kendall's mint cakes. If you don't know what they are, they're about this, the size of a really large chocolate bar. They're sugar and water melted down together with a little peppermint flavoring, and they're poured into a mold till they harden. And so it's like a big chunk of sugar. It's not very tasty. But the selling point for the Kendall's mint cakes was that on the wrapper of the mint cake was a picture of Sir Edmund Hillary, and behind him, a picture of Mount Everest. So we were pretty sure if it worked for Sir Edmund Hillary, it would work for us. We got dozens of those. We also got several dozen boxes, I think, of this cereal called Familia. The advertising was that you could eat it hot or cold. It's really filling. It's nutritious. Perfect for us for backpacking. It had a picture of a little happy Swiss family on the front of it. And so we thought that was good. It was easy to sell us by pictures on covers. And then we got something called pemmican bars. I think they're fruit. Oh, yeah, you know. Okay, they're not that tasty either. And their close cousin, the meat bar. The less said about the meat bar, the better. If Michael Pollan tasted a meat bar today, he would call it an edible food-like product. And I think that the edible is a bit of a stretch. But we had dozens of those. And then the pièce de résistance for the whole trip was these tropical chocolate bars made by Hershey. We thought that'd be great at the end of the day. We're, wanting a little something sweet and have some chocolate. And the reason they're called tropical is because they don't melt in the heat. So that's great. We're going to be in the back of our car for 4 months. We don't have to worry about them melting. There's a reason they don't melt in the heat. And that is because they're made with something, I think, akin to paraffin. And they taste like eating candles. So they turned out not to be that great of a treat. But that's all right. We had boxes and boxes delivered to our apartment before we left. We packed them all in the back of the car. We're almost ready to go, but there was one other sort of preparatory thing we had to do. We were going to be backpacking, but we're also looking for a place to settle down. We knew we wanted to live somewhere in the American West. And there's a little something you have to know about the two of us here, and that is that my husband, Larry, is the man for whom the Excel spreadsheet was invented. He is a spreadsheet freak. He has everything on spreadsheet. I, on the other hand, am a daydreamer. If it had been up to me, we would still be sitting at the kitchen table in Wisconsin looking at the maps. So he got out the 1973 version of the Excel spreadsheet, which is a yellow legal pad, and we listed 8 or 10 cities that we thought we were interested in, and we had all the columns and rows, and so precipitation, elevation, population, average daily highs and lows. You could not Google that in 1973. It took a lot of work. So we're all ready to go. We get in the car, May 1973. We head south. We go to Kansas City, drop off our few belongings at my parents' house there, and then we head directly west. And our first real backpacking trip was in the canyon country of southeastern Utah. We hooked up with a bunch of experienced backpackers for that very first trip, and the way we hooked up with them is a story for another time because it's too long to tell tonight, but we were extremely lucky and so happy and joyful that we got to join with this other group. And we learned the very first day that we hiked with these people, we learned three things that Colin had never taught us. The first thing is you cannot get your feet ready for backpacking by walking around Madison in your hiking boots. I have the worst blisters I ever had before or since or ever hope to have. The second thing is that real backpackers go skinny dipping. Now, okay, I know this was the time of free love and Haight-Ashbury and Woodstock. I can only say that I had led a pretty sheltered life up until this point, and I had never been skinny dipping. But at the end of the very first day, we got to this clear, deep, gorgeous pool of water in this red rock, amazing canyon. And everybody stripped off their clothes. And I decided that was a pretty good idea. The third thing we learned, real backpackers don't eat meat bars. After we swam, we went to this nice place in the shade, and one person brought out a bottle of 100-proof rum, and another person brought out some tins of smoked oysters. And this was pretty good eating. And my husband and I looked at each other, kind of silently thinking about the meat bars in the back of the Plymouth. It's very much akin to what Arlo Guthrie must have felt when he looked at the blind judge and the 27 8x10 color glossy photographs with the circles and arrows. If you're under 60, you won't get the reference, but you can ask an older person. So we had a great time on that trip. We took our first baby backpacking steps. By the end of the trip, we had our backpacking legs. And we headed from south to north following the summer, put one foot in front of the other for 4 months. And we went from the end of one trail to the beginning of the next. We slept one night on a high ledge in a canyon, listening for the roar of the flash flood that we thought was coming. We had our hair stand on end on a Colorado mountaintop in a thunderstorm. We scrambled up scree slopes. We fell exhausted into camp. I think we ate some meat bars. And at the end of the summer, we found ourselves without much money left, and you might have guessed this already, Boise, Idaho. It was on the spreadsheet. And the next 37 years passed, as it seems now, almost like a dream. We moved all of the leftover Kendall's mint cakes, meat bars, and tropical chocolate into our basement. And some years after that, we were doing some spring cleaning, and we decided that the probability of there ever being a famine of such proportion that we would need to break into that food was extremely low. So in spite of the fact that we were both raised in very frugal Midwestern homes, we took it out to the trash. Don't tell our parents. And the years ambled on one after the other, and the events of that summer got stored in deep memory and on piles of Kodachrome that are stuffed in the back closet that our kids will have to throw away after we die. And on and off, one of the memories will resurface, and I'll think of it and enjoy the memory. And it's occurred to me from time to time that to wonder if there was a metaphor in any of those experiences for our life since then. The obvious ones come to mind: climbing tall mountains, crossing raging rivers, being one footfall away from the edge of a crevasse. But even though I'm the first one that starts crying at high school graduation when the high school choir sings Climb Every Mountain, those are pretty cliched, really overused, and just didn't work. There is one memory that survives that summer with particular clarity, and it's a little perplexing why it survives. Toward the end of the summer, we noticed that we had an uninvited guest in our car. The familiar cereal boxes had been chewed into. There were little pieces of cardboard and cereal strewn around the back of the car. And even though we were not fond of familiar cereal, it was our food for the summer. So we pulled up beside an empty field to see if we could discover what was going on. We pulled everything out of the back of the car looking for the perpetrator. We found nothing at first until we opened up the wheel well where the spare tire lived. And in the hub of that spare tire was a family of tiny, hairless, pink baby mice and their mommy. Well, the minute we opened up that wheel well and I saw those mice, I was mesmerized. I was completely transfixed with those darling little baby mice. Daydreamer, remember. Okay. And I turned around and Larry is standing behind me with a shovel over his head, poised over the baby mice, ready to bludgeon them to death. So Mr. Spreadsheet, in the minutes that I was daydreaming, had gotten the yellow legal pad out. He had gone through every algorithm and come to this inescapable conclusion: the mice had to be dispatched. I screamed at him, "What are you thinking? You can't kill those baby mice." "Well, what are we going to do?" Well, this was a problem because I'd been daydreaming. I didn't have a plan. So I had to think really fast. I said, "How about if we just put them in this field over here?" "Well, a cat's just going to get them." "That's okay. That's the way of the world if that's what happens." He looks at me like I'm out of my mind, but he puts the shovel down. And we carried the little baby mice one by one over to the empty field, to their new home, and whatever their eventual fate may have been. And it occurs to me now at this distant remove that the reason that this seemingly insignificant event has grafted itself so strongly onto the memory of that summer is because that's the metaphor for the summer. As it turns out, we didn't have very many tall mountains to climb. We had very few raging rivers, but we have had a multitude of daily differences, landmines to walk around and negotiate, times when one or the other of us has had to put down the poised shovel and consider the other person's point of view. I think that's why, from time to time and in no particular context, one or the other of us will say, "Remember those baby mice?" That's my story. Thank you for listening.
Do you want to be like Jan and become a featured storyteller for Story Story Night? If you have a powerful 10 to 15 minute story on an upcoming theme, submit a complete synopsis now to storystorynight@live.com. Of course, you can also be spontaneous and put your name in our Story Slam hat at the event. That's exactly what Ben Dykus did in August. And here's his winning story from the night, reminding us all to count heads before leaving a rest stop.
This is a Dog Day summer story. It's a story in really two parts. One part belongs to my wife. I'll just have to give you my part. This is the 1960s. We have my wife and I, four sons who are rather close together in age, two of them twins. And we had a Volkswagen bus, which we had taken all the seats out except the front seats, and to build a platform in the back, and which we put down mattresses and sleeping bags, so that when we traveled, we would wake the boys up, carry them down, put them in the back there, and then they would sleep while we drove. And we found it efficacious to get off early in the morning so we could have as much peace as we could. Four boys in the back can get up to some interesting mischief during the day when you're traveling. So we were headed for Colorado. And as it turned out, that sometimes when one of us was driving, the other would go back and go to sleep if with the boys in the back. And I was driving, and we were in eastern Colorado. We were headed for Colorado Springs to visit a friend, a relative. And I pulled into a gas station and filled up with gas, and everybody was sound asleep in the back. So I finished that and got into the driver's seat and drove off. And about an hour later, we were approaching an exit towards Denver, and I said, "Diana, wake up, because I'm not sure where I'm supposed to go from here." And there's no response. So I turned to our son, John, who was awake, and I said, "Well, get your mother up, because I need to know what exit I'm supposed to take." And he said, "She's not here." So I said, "That's impossible. Look around." He said, "I am looking around." I said, "Well, we'll look under the pillows." And there was no Diana. So I get off where I can and turn around and start heading back to this small gas station, which is now another hour going the other way. And of course, all four boys have to go to the bathroom. So, and if you owned a Volkswagen bus in those days, you know that when you floor it, maybe 50. So so I head back, and we get back to the gas station, and I go in, and the guy said, "Oh, yeah." He said, your wife, I should explain, too, that this being the 60s, Diana was in very short shorts and a T-shirt, and He said she got on the bus, and she has said to tell you that she was headed on the bus to Colorado Springs. So I said, oh, God, here we go. So we jumped into the bus and started back in the other direction. And as I'm going out of town, one of the boys says, Dad, there's Mom. And I said, don't be silly. We've got things to do here. We've got to really pay. So fortunately, I happened to look in the rearview mirror, and there was Mom. So I turned around again and went back and picked up Mom. We didn't say a lot to each other at that point. So we drove for a while, and we decided we better stop for dinner. It was beginning to get dusk, and so we went into... now, I should tell you, this being the 60s, my beard was much longer, and my hair was much longer, and our boy's hair was quite long. And we went into this diner. There were several pickups out front with, the gun racks in the back. And we sat down, and pretty soon there was talk about my son wouldn't have a beard like that. And so finally the manager came over and said, it's getting dusk. I think he really ought to leave. So we... I'll give you a quick version since I Diana didn't sign up, so she can't come up here to tell you her version. Oh, there we go. Just real quickly, she and her venture actually on a bus going to saw us go back the other way, so she convinced the bus driver to let her off. And he said, we can't do that out here in this country. She said, you've got to, because that's my husband. So she got off. She went up to a ranch house because she was going to use the phone to call the gas station to tell them that where she was. And the door was, nobody was there, and the phone was ringing but in that ranch house. So she had her own adventure. Perhaps another time, Diana. Okay, thanks.
Thanks for listening. Story Night is brought to you by founding partners Alley Repertory Theater, the Boise State Story Initiative, and The Cabin. Venue partner, The Linen Building. Design partner, Neighborhood All-Stars. And importantly, our broadcast partner, Boise State Public Radio, who makes this podcast possible. Please donate now at radio.boisestate.edu. The Story Night theme song is by musician Dan Costello. Hear more at hearcostello.com. Please join us next week for more Stories of Summer, and we'll see you September 27th for White Lies, Stories of Polite Fictions. Learn more at storystorynight.org.